Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And we will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 51. And Jeremy, would you please tell us about Senate Bill 51?
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 51, the original bill, requires the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries to establish by order, each biennium, the amount of fee paid by public agencies awarding public works contracts adequate to pay costs of surveys, administration, and education relating to prevailing wage law. It establishes a fee between 0.1 and 0.2% of each contract. It increases the minimum fee to $250 and eliminates the maximum fee. Requires the commissioner to set forth in rule basis for determining the fee. Declares emergency effective upon passage. It has no revenue impact, and we do not have a fiscal on it. Subsequently, we received a dash 2 amendment that we believe the agency wants to bring to us, and that changes the amount in those fees, and the agency will tell us about it.
Great. And our first witness is Kate Newhall, if you'd like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome back to our committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm the Legislative and Communications Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 51, and as Jeremy said, I am going to be testifying to the Dash 2 amendments, which would replace the entire original bill. Let me begin. Thank you for holding this hearing today and allowing us the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 51 and the Dash 2 amendment. Senate Bill 51-2 relates to the reauthorization of the prevailing wage rate fee and is an important bill for us at the Bureau of Labor and Industries and for the proper administration of prevailing wage rate law. Because this is such an important bill for us, we have been working with affected stakeholders to develop the Dash 2 amendment and believe that it does reflect a reasonable solution to ensuring a stable funding mechanism for prevailing wage rate law enforcement and administration. As you know, Oregon's PWR law requires that workers on public construction projects be paid wages and benefits found to be prevailing for similar work in or near the same locality. In Oregon, our prevailing wage rates are set based on an annual survey of construction occupations that is conducted by the Oregon Employment Department. And the Bureau of Labor and Industries enforces Oregon's prevailing wage rate law. The administration and the enforcement of prevailing wage rate law, including our educational seminars, rate book publications, and the annual construction survey, is funded entirely with PWR fees that are paid for by the contracting agencies and deposited in the prevailing wage enforcement and education account. And like I said, the prevailing wage rate fee is what pays for both the annual construction survey, the various rate book publications, and the technical assistance seminars and educational outreach that the agency does. Currently, the fee is calculated at 0.1% of the total contract price and has a minimum and maximum amount set in statute. In 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 2021, which temporarily set a fee minimum of $250 and a maximum of $7,500. And this temporary adjustment in the minimum and maximum is set to sunset on January 1st, 2011. And effective January 1, 2011, the temporary fee will revert back to the minimum of $100 and a maximum of $5,000. Unfortunately, allowing the current fee minimum and maximum to revert back to $100 and $5,000 leaves BOLI with insufficient revenues to sustain prevailing wage administration and enforcement efforts. BOLI anticipates that without legislation that would provide for fee adjustments, the PWR enforcement and education account will not have sufficient revenues to sustain PWR administration activities shortly after the 11-13 biennium. So, in order to maintain long-term solvency in the PWR enforcement and education account and the proper administration of PWR law, Senate Bill 51-2 proposes two statutory changes. First, it permanently reauthorizes the current minimum and maximum fee of $250 and $7,500. And second, it allows the Labor Commissioner to adjust the PWR fee percentage in an amount between 0.1 and 0.125% of the total contract price. With these two changes, we anticipate that PWR fee revenues would be sufficient to sustain prevailing wage administration and enforcement activities in the future. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify, and with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony, and before I forget to remind members of the audience, if you could please turn off your cell phones and PDAs, they do interfere with our recording equipment here. Are there any questions for Ms. Newhall? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it was there, maybe it was here. How long has the fee been $105,000?
I'm not sure. I would be happy to get that information and follow up with you.
That
Hold
would
on,
be
let
helpful.
Me turn around and see if my... Do you know how long the fee is? It's been $105,000. I know the current minimum and maximum was set in 2007, the $250 and $7,500. But I will get that information and follow back with you, hopefully by the end of the committee today.
And is that, did you have an additional question? Was the sunset that you referred to, that must be in the section that's being repealed then?
It is not. It actually is in ORS 279C.825. And what there actually is there's a subsection there that relates to the sunset, and it says for the dates between January 1, 2008 and January 1, 2011, and then it sets the specific specific minimum and maximum for that date range.
Great, because I didn't see it in the bill, so that's
because weird. Essentially I think on December 31st, 2010, that section will just come off.
I see. Okay, thank you. Additional questions? Yes, Senator George.
Just one quick question. Kate, if you could, when you respond to Senator Telfer, could you just bring back kind of like a quick budget of this is how much the fee brings in and this is what we spend it on, just so I can kind of see that. Any idea politically why the 2007 legislature chose to put a sunset clause on that? What was the discussion around that made the legislature put in a sunset clause so that we know whether we should extend the sunset or whether we should just get rid of the sunset?
Unfortunately, I can't speak to that because I didn't work for the Bureau in 2007, but I do know that the minimum and maximum was adjusted in 2007 because the revenue was insufficient to support the enforcement and outreach activities.
Okay. Thank you.
Great, and we'll get that. And if you could provide that information to the administrator, we'll probably share it with all the committee members.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. That looks like that answers all of our questions. And our next witness is Joe Esmond. Would like to come forward?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. Joe Esmond from the IBW, Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. I just want to come out in support of Senate Bill 51. Quite frankly, they're usually overworked, and they do a very good job for the union or non-union. They're very... very professional, and I'm very impressed over the years with their outreach, going out to, and as you probably know, PWR language is as confusing sometimes as cap and trade language, but they did do a very good job getting the word out. So that is all.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? Doesn't look like it. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so is there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 51? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 51, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 51. Members, we will not be able to move the bill today because we don't have the fiscal impact, but we do have a Dash 2 amendment before us. Senator Telfer?
I would move that the Dash 2 amendment be incorporated into Senate Bill 51.
Senate Bill 51, right. Senator Telfer has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 51. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, the amendment is adopted. And that's all we can do with it today, so I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 51. And I think next we will move to Senate Bill 710, so I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 710. And Jeremy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 710 directs the Department of Education to conduct study on career and technical education and report to the department on results. appropriates monies from general fund, directs department to establish consistent criteria for 2+2 programs to be used by school districts and community colleges. It directs establishment of an implied baccalaureate degree for certain occupations. It changes professional technical education to career and technical education, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009. It has no revenue impact. We do not have fiscal, and again, we have an amendment which has been provided, which substantially changes the entire bill, and I'm sure we'll hear about that amendment.
Actually, I think I will temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 710 because I do see that Senator Morse has joined us, and he is here on another bill, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 733. And Senator Morse, if you could just stay with us for a moment. Jeremy, please explain this bill.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 733 directs the governor to use methodology approved by Community College Forecast Committee established in Executive Order 07-12 in calculating the essential budget for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, declares an emergency effective on passage. We have no revenue impact. We do not have a fiscal, and I did include the language from the Executive Order 0712 in the background section of the SMS.
Thank you. And Senator Morse, welcome to the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Frank Morse, Senate, representing District 8, Albany-Corvallis area. And thank you very much for hearing this bill. I would like to just put it in context in my understanding of where we have come from in thinking about this enterprise we call education. For many, many years, we operated in silos. We had the K through 12 silo, we had the community college silo, and we had the OUS silo. And with our present governor and his leadership, we have begun to think differently, and as have many, many states, about the pre-K through 20 model as not silos, but as one consistent enterprise. One of the major flaws, I believe, that we encounter when we look at this issue is what is the appropriate level of funding for community colleges? And when the budget is prepared under one set of assumptions and circumstances for, again, one of these pieces in this education enterprise, the community college, then we're at a loss to know, really, what is the appropriate level of funding as compared to OUS. When we have essential budget level calculations in the governor's recommended budget for OUS, we have the equivalent, have had historically, the equivalent of a contractor status for community colleges. And as you know, that contractor status, when the budget is prepared, is generally an inflation issue of 3%, 2.7, whatever that is. So we don't know, as legislators, what is the appropriate essential budget level to maintain what it is that we have in our community colleges and how our community college fund supports that. So what this bill is an attempt to put into the statute a requirement that when the governor's recommended budget is prepared, that it be prepared with the same assumption or similar assumptions that we use for the rest of government. Now, what I have had is conversations with Steve Bender of Legislative Fiscal, and they do have concerns about the language of this bill. What they're saying is that the using the recommendation of the Community College Forecast Committee Technical Work Group really does not work, because the method of calculating the essential budget level for K through 12 is not the same as for OUS. There are different assumptions. OUS is a different model in that you have tuition income. You have essentially a business enterprise that's much different than the K through 12 model. The recommendations from the Community College Forecast Committee, what we have under the advisement of legislative fiscal, is that that would not be the appropriate method to put in statute. On the other hand, the method that is consistent with the OUS calculation of the essential budget level would be appropriate. So in matter of full disclosure, I wanted the committee to know of what legislative fiscal's evaluation of this bill would be. So I suspect that the community college may have a request that they think in terms of the what was recommended, but it may require a little bit of work in order to bring the minds together into something that will work. But what I would like to impress upon you is the need to get away from this silo concept and a contractor relationship to where community colleges are a part of this education enterprise, and that they're treated in the same way that we do the other parts of our, most certainly, the Oregon University system. So, Madam Chair and colleagues, that's the spirit in which I bring this bill forward. I think it's a step in the right direction if we can find the appropriate language that would give direction to the governor when he prepares his recommended budget.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Senator Morse? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you proposing a dash one to adjust the wording? And if so, are you considering it on the Senate side or the House side?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, you know, this knowledge just emerged, okay, with legislative fiscal. So I've not had a chance to process this with the community college folks. If there's time to do that, I think the amendment would be pretty straightforward. If we can do it on this side, would very much prefer to do that. But I think as long as we have legislative fiscal that's saying there are some issues, we have to deal with those issues so that what we put out is a product that works in that budget process.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for
being
here. We do have some other witnesses signed up, actually three of them, and so I think I'll call them all up together. Preston Pulliams, Jim Huckstein, and Frank Goulard. If the three of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon, and
good afternoon.
Welcome to our committee. Whichever of you wants to go first.
All right, I guess I'll start. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Preston Williams. I'm District President for Portland Community College, and today I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Community College Association, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 733. Before I begin, I do want to extend our thanks to Senator Morse for his work and determination in carrying this issue forward. We'd also like to thank the work and commitment of Senator Devlin for introducing this issue in the 2007 legislation season, in which he negotiated compromise regarding this issue. This bill addresses the need for an essential budget level for community colleges that more accurately reflect the costs needed to continue operating at the same level of service. Without a far more accurate EBL, legislators will not have a critical reference point which they need to make some pretty difficult and well-informed budget decisions. It is not that colleges believe that a new EBL guarantees a particular level of funding. In such a deep recession, we know there are no guarantees. But when faced with no good decisions, as this body may well be, inadequate data undermines informed decision-making at a time when the consequences of those decisions are potentially severe and long-lasting. The community colleges in Oregon have been at a disadvantage by this process to determine this level for several years. Unlike state agencies, the EBL for community colleges is calculated by applying a simple services and supplies inflationary factor to the current budget, which fails to recognize the actual increased cost in PERS, health insurance, salaries, utilities, and other cost inflators. In the 07 legislative session, Senator Devlin introduced Senate Bill 973, which directed the Department of Administrative Services to forecast an allowable growth factor for community colleges. That bill did not pass, as the governor's office negotiated a fix of the issue through an executive order. In August 2007, the governor issued executive order number 07-12, mandated the Department of Administrative Services calculate a new EBL in May and December of each numbered year. However, that work was not completed. Senate Bill 733 simply mandates the fulfillment of this executive order. Community colleges and the legislators must have a new EBL for 09-11 budget cycle based on a new methodology, while recognizing that because of budget cuts, community colleges will not be funded at the EBL level. An accurate level, therefore, must be determined as a starting point for these budget reductions. This legislation guarantees a commitment made in the 07 session to address this issue. That ends my written remarks. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to address this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. And I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from the entire panel.
My name, for the record, is James Huckstein. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Operations at Lynn Benton Community College. I'm going to just talk about what the effects of the EBL calculation that we currently have and what the technical working group came up with as far as a new EBL calculation and how that would change the EBL. In the current EBL that was used to calculate the Community College Support Fund for the 2009-2011, the components are the property taxes received as well as the state appropriation. That is multiplied by a growth factor, which was the gross domestic product price deflator, which is about 2.8% for the biennium. That gives us a rolled up budget amount. And then we back out the new property taxes that were levied above the prior biennium, and you're derived with the EBL for community colleges. The new methodology does something first before. It gets to that step. It looks at all the costs that were actually incurred at the community colleges over their over the recent history. For instance, a three-year average of salary and benefit increases. It looks at actual increases in insurance rates that OEB has announced. Most of the colleges are participating in OEB, and so our insurance rates are using the same state number that is used for state agencies and other K-12 districts for insurance. PERS costs based on actual rates that the entities have at the community colleges. And then the salaries are delineated by the different employee groups, management, classified, faculty, part-time faculty, part-time classified, things like that. And then materials and supplies using the same calculation inflators as the current formula does. When the technical work group looked at the how different factors might impact the EBL calculation, we looked at things like what is the K-12 factor for increasing salaries and benefits, what is the state of Oregon state employees factor for increasing salaries, and we also looked at 10 years of historical data that the community colleges supplied to CCWD as well as DAS. So we have provided them information which we can build a better assumption on. The three different factors, when each of those components is weighted based on how much each component is of the total budget, and given an independent factor and rolled up. The different factors came out. If we use a state of Oregon or state employee inflator for salaries and wages, it came out to 8.16%. When we used K-12, it was 5.92%. And when we used the community colleges data to derive it, it was 7.54%. So that compares not very favorably to the 2.8% that is actually used in our EBL calculation. So if everything else was the same, in the current model that was used for the governor's recommended budget, the EBL level came to $493 million. If that also overstated property taxes at that time. If all we do is correct for property taxes, the essential budget level would be $500 million. If we use the least of those growth factors, the K-12 growth factor, the EBL would have been $523 million. If we use the community college derived data, we would have come up with about, let's see what it is. I think it was $530-something million dollars. So there is a significant reduction, and from the old EBL calculation and these modified versions. So essentially, when using the most conservative of the estimates, which would be similar to the K-12 model, the EBL has essentially been cut by 5.72% compared to what it would have been under the new calculation. And so community colleges are put into a hole. Now, this has happened in prior biennials as well, but it's hard to give legislators and the governor the proper number without an accurate EBL calculation. And so the committee, technical working group, which approved the methodology that DAS came up with, that uses these different weighting factors and uses for the community college data or a substitute in the first year, would provide a much more accurate EBL calculation than what we currently have. To speak to the notion of LFO's objections to some of the data, LFO is wanting to make sure that the budget that actually is produced is, I guess, similar into how the state employees or the state employees' budgets are incremented, and that is any contracts that are in place, the increment goes through. If the contract's not in place, then there's money set aside. It goes into the emergency board for action later in case salary increases are approved. In the K-12 side, which is what we modeled ours after, it does look at historical data to project what future salary increases are. We recognize that community colleges are slightly different from K-12. They're also slightly different from OUS. So we were using sort of a hybrid method to come up with the best available numbers that we could get. We felt we were such a so far from reality in the current EBL methodology that by using the methodology that we came up with, that we were a far cry from the really poorly designed number of the current EBL calculation, and we wanted to move leaps and bounds to something more accurate, and that was the best recommendation that we could come up with. We would like to know what the future brings as far as using the best possible numbers. You don't always have those when you're trying to figure out what's happening in the next couple of years. But so with that.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, Frank Goulard. I'm at Portland Community College as a faculty member. I'm also the department chair of math at that campus, Sylvania campus of Portland Community College. I have a different perspective. I've taught in K through 12. I've taught at PCC for the last 27 years. I taught at Oregon State University briefly with my major professor as a GTA there. So I feel what Senator Morse stated earlier as far as the continuum, or this enterprise that he called it. It really is a continuum, and I think we can all kind of picture it, of course, K through 20. How could it not be a continuum? But it's a continuum more than just the numbers, 12th grade or 13th and so on up through the university level. It's a continuum in the way that the students that, for example, I get at Portland Community College in the math department, we get 11,000 students a year just at my campus with 50 different faculty teaching them and helping them and nurturing them, helping them succeed. And of course, eventually, they're out as better trained and better educated citizens so they can be contributing members of our society of here in the state of Oregon, helping us fellow Oregonians into the future. And so back to the continuum concept, when Mr. Huckstein mentioned about the hybrid approach, and in my mind, as a statistics and mathematical mind, that seemed to be the best approach now, and I know it will be continue to be refined as data keeps coming along, but the hybrid approach does seem to be the most fair and reasonable approach for now, and they pegged that anywhere from an EBL of $519 million to $530 million, as he stated. And I know, and we all know in this room, that $519 million is likely not what community colleges are going to receive in the next biennium. But the critical or more important thing is it sets a good benchmark, a good reference point for all of us, you folks in particular, along with your fellow legislators, to look at and say, all right, that's what it should have been. Like other state agencies, like K through 12 and OUS, it likely won't be that high at their maximum EBL levels either. But it's important to know that it's not 485 or 470 or some smaller number that came from poor assumptions. This EBL figure that the technical work group came with the admirable leadership from Bill McGee, the DAS person in charge, is a very sound and soundly based figure. So I urge you to look at that. That's very important as a benchmark, as something to work from as you go into the future. Lastly, the students that come to us at the community colleges, as you know, some of them go on the university system as a transfer. Some are career technical edge folks. They stay for 1 or 2 years, get a certificate, then they go out in the field and do admirable jobs, whether it be welding, aviation science, automotive technology, repair, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. But I think the key is those students, when they come to the community colleges, many of them, for them, we are their social safety net. We are the economic first responders, especially in times like we're living through now. If it's not for the community colleges, they're on the street. They're adding to our unfortunate higher unemployment rate we're experiencing now. So please remember community colleges, but more importantly, remember the fair and reasonable way to assess how is an EBL calculated and what is it best served for, in this case, a proper number from which you can base your judicious decisions from. That, I thank you for your time, and the three of us are open for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Okay, looks like you have answered all of our questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. And that completes the sign-up list. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 733? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 733. And I'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 710. And I think we'd had the explanation of this bill. So let's just go back to our witness list, and I'll call Deborah Barnes. Thank you for waiting so patiently while we heard the other bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and the rest of the committee. My name is Deborah Barnes, and I am a teacher in the North Clackamas School District at the Sabin Schellenberg Professional Technical Center. 15 years ago, I gave up a job in broadcasting so I could teach high school kids what I thought was pretty important, communication skills, meeting deadlines, working well with others. And for the past 15 years, I've been honored to work for the North Clackamas School District. This Senate Bill 710 is actually an outcome of several bills that we've gone through for several sessions, trying to explain the importance of career and technical education in Oregon. I was a part of the Workforce Task Force 2005 group, appointed by the legislature as one of the only teachers on that group, to study why or why not Oregon was or was not behind funding in CTE in the United States. The results were very grim for me as a teacher. It was really eye-opening. Every other state, including Oregon and Washington and California, had much higher revenue sources for career and technical education. They actually focused in with new funding for the buildings, for teachers, and for the equipment. At the Sabin-Schulenburg Technical Center, we have 3,000 students attending every single day. We have 21 different programs ranging from marketing and management, sports marketing. We have nursing and health services, engineering, manufacturing, you name it, we have it. And kids who are close to dropping out of high school get on buses from our three high schools, Putnam, Clackamas, and Milwaukee, and come out for either one class or two at Sabin-Schulenburg on one of our four campuses. And those kids that are close to dropping out, they find their niche. They get excited because they find something that they can feel passionate about, whether it be in my classroom in front of a television station monitor, learning how to edit, or maybe they go out to Providence Milwaukee Hospital and watch a baby being born. Workforce development for us is giving those kids tools to meet deadlines, work well with others, show up to work on time, and they get college credit. Students who complete my program through 3 years, 15 college credits through CCC. Many of our kids have gone on to the community colleges and then four-year universities. I was very lucky to have one of my students turn out to be the editor of the show Las Vegas, and then came back to the classroom and told the rest of the students what it was like and what he had learned in that classroom on that antiquated equipment and made him believe he could do something with his life. Ended up in Los Angeles on a major network show, and he was proud of it and shared it with his students. This bill is asking you to look at yet, I know, another study. But this study says that the three schools that you have the Oregon Department of Education give a grant to will give 50% of a matching form back. In other words, you give Sabin-Schulenburg $100,000 to prove to you that those kids can succeed in math and science and English, as well as those soft skills I talked about, North Clackamas will chip in 50% of that grant. So it's not like we're asking for a handout. We're asking for funding to show once again that not every child learns through a piece of paper and a pencil. Some kids learn and stay in high school and actually graduate and go on and become important kids. They find that they found their niche. They want to go to college. And if they only go to community college, they have some talent to go right into the workforce. So what I'm asking for, and there's, think of those 3,000 kids at my school, for the $100,000 you invest at Sabin-Schulenburg to prove that these kids can do this, you're going to get 50% of that funding from my district, and I can show to you, and I'll bring those kids here, every single one of them, and they'll tell you what it's like to sit in a classroom where they can do something and learn at the same time. And then they feel good about themselves and they want to stay in school. And in the meantime, they learn math skills and science skills and language arts skills because they don't ask, why do I need to learn this math thing? Because they do it without even having to ask. So that's what we're asking for with this bill. And that's why my school district let me off this afternoon to come down and explain it to you. If you have any questions, I'd be here. I'm glad to answer them.
Hey, any questions?
Sure.
Senator George.
I had the pleasure to actually visit North Clackamas High School with one of your administrators who used to be one of your ag teachers. And it's a fabulous, amazing program they have at North Clackamas. And I'm just amazed at the work you guys are doing in technical and vocational training. And they kind of took me through a tour, and I just was really impressed at how you coordinate all high schools, how they coordinate all the schedules, how they get these kids into prepping for firefighting, all kinds of different things. It really is amazing. And so I would encourage the committee, if you get a chance, take up an offer to go see what North Clackamas School District is doing. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your comment. Other questions? Yes, Senator Duffy.
I have a question, and it's more to the committee. early on in the session, we had a presentation from the workforce development that the State Department's doing. Does it tie in here at all, or is it strictly at a higher degree level?
If you're asking me...
No. Maybe because those individuals aren't here in the room.
Yeah.
I just wondered... It
can
does
certainly
that program where
get
they're
an
looking
answer
at.
For you. I don't have the answer to your question.
Because I know there's some workforce development and looking at education, what's needed, what a career, you know, jobs versus just moving on to a four-year degree. A lot of that's already happening, and I just wondered if there's an opportunity here to work together on that since that program's already in place.
I can't answer that specific question, but I do know that Clackamas County considers the Sabin-Schellenberg Center part of its economic development package.
Maybe I could help by asking what, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
What's the connection between the center and the skills center and the local community colleges or other entities, other community colleges?
I'm glad you asked. If I may answer?
Yep.
We have articulation agreements, which means that I have an advisory panel made up of experts in the field. Steve Dunn from Channel 2, the union president of AFTRA. Every program has an advisory panel. That gives us the opportunity to have what we call an articulation agreement, a 2+2, where it's part of the, you just heard, we're part of the system. My students get the credits, the 15 college credits through CCC, but we have connections with CCC, Mount Hood, PCC, and now we're working on an agreement so that my students get an integrated media studies degree from CCC and they can transfer those credits, and that's the big problem we haven't fixed in this state. Not all those college credits will transfer to the four-year the college, and that's the problem. My kids will take those classes, they'll get the credit at the CCC, but will the University of Oregon accept those college credits? This is all part of that study so that we can streamline. The kids get the high school credit, go all the way through, and whatever they've learned in my class is the same stuff that they'll be learning and get college credit for it at U of O. Why make them repeat the same thing three times?
And Senator Munis Anderson, did you have a question?
I just wanted to make a comment. If you notice in the Dash 1's amendments on line 14, it mentions the Center for Advanced Learning. And I just wanted you to know the Center for Advanced Learning is located in my district. It is a charter school. Like a charter school, and the demand, there has to be actually a lottery system for people to get into it. And there are three areas. There's the healthcare component, and people can actually become certified nursing assistants. And in the same building is the nursing school for the community college. And so there's a nexus that way with the community college. And we also have the healthcare technology emphasis and then the manufacturing emphasis. And believe me, it's a highly successful program and really does set people down the lines on whether they like a certain area or they don't. And I just feel that we need to be doing more of this because we're still losing 20 to 25% of our students to dropouts, and I know that we could save some of these people if they would get into these career training programs.
Thank you for your comment. And that actually does bring up the Dash 1 amendment. Were your comments in reference to the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Okay, I don't see any other questions, so
thank
you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 710? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 710, and that does complete our agenda, so we are adjourned.